The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to the 2017 Internal Medicine Board Review Course, sponsored by the American College of Osteopathic Internists. The course was held March 22nd through 26th, 2017, at the JW Marriott Las Vegas Resort and Spa. The course featured nationally known speakers presenting a wide variety of topics of interest to the internist preparing for certification or recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Cancer in men, prostate, testis, and kidney is presented by Dr. Kevin Hubbard.
We'll start talking first of all about cancer in men. We're going to cover three major topics: bladder cancer, which admittedly there are women with bladder cancer as well, but we wanted to fit that in and we had to put it somewhere, so it wound up in the cancer in men presentation. We'll also talk about prostate cancer and testicular cancer as well. So bladder cancer is the most frequent uroepithelial tumor that we encounter. It's about 75,000 cases per year and about 15,000 deaths per year. Male to female ratio was 3-1. Most of these are going to occur in patients between the ages of 50 and 80. Most common focus is going to be on the posterior and lateral walls of the bladder. It's important to think of in terms of this concept of field cancerization. That is to say, the entire bladder is susceptible to toxin exposure. Second primaries are very common in that situation. In fact, the risk of bladder cancer can be increased in as much as 2 to 3 times in urbanites as compared with others. We know that there are certain carcinogens that we have to think about as well. Again, an increased incidence in smokers. Most important risk factors in westernized countries, in fact, is the prevalence of smoking. What about secondhand smoke? Well, it's been implicated in women with bladder cancer, not as direct a correlation in men, but we definitely see a correlation in women exposed to secondhand smoke. So if they give you a test question and they give you somebody who's working in the rubber, textile, leather, chemical materials, paint, metal workers, laboratory industries, all of those patients are going to have an increased risk. Those patients who were taking Chinese herbs, a lot of those herbs are going to contain aristolochic acid, and aristolochic acid is something the nephrologist brought up yesterday as a cause of Balkan nephropathy. It also predisposes patients to transitional cell carcinoma of the renal pelvis, and so there's a potential risk for a problem is in that particular setting. Now, that's a urothelial carcinoma, of course, rather than primary renal cell carcinoma. Schistosoma hematobium, if you've got patients who get exposed, squamous carcinoma of the bladder, the way that I like to remember that is it makes the sound. So squamous carcinoma, schistosoma. So if it starts with an S, it's squamous carcinoma. Certainly a concern. Transitional cell carcinomas are going to account for 90 to 95% of all bladder cancers that we're going to see. Squamous carcinomas and adenocarcinomas are going to account for the bulk of the remainder. You can see primary sarcoma of the bladder. Leiomyosarcoma is a possibility, but it really is not at all common in that situation. So in looking at the pathology, we divide these up into low-grade and high-grade carcinomas. The low-grades typically are going to recur after treatment, but it rarely invades. I kind of think of it as kind of like skin cancer. You know, you have these low-grade lesions that can occur on the skin, and you have to go in and keep an eye on them and fulgrate them off or treat them topically or do things with them periodically, but they don't metastasize. And so that's kind of the thought that I have in terms of trying to relate this to bladder carcinoma. On the other hand, we've got high-grade carcinomas, which recur after treatment, has a strong tendency to invade the muscular layer of the bladder, very high proclivity to metastasize. In fact, most of the deaths that we're going to see that are secondary to metastatic bladder cancer are going to be these high-grade malignancies. The clinical presentation typically is going to be hematuria, and the classic presentation is painless hematuria. That's a classic presentation for bladder cancer. You'll see it in about 70% of patients who are found to have bladder carcinoma. Bladder irritability can occur in about 25% of patients, and at the time they're diagnosed, 70% of bladder cancers are confined to the bladder. Only 7% have clinical evidence of metastases. So we do get to this pretty early in the course of disease the majority of the time. Urinary obstructive symptoms can occur as well. This happens when the tumor occurs near the urethral ostium. Sometimes you get a little tumor, it's kind of pedunculated, and it just kind of acts like a ball valve, just kind of flips in and out. So patients will come in and say, you know, I was voiding, everything was fine, and then all of a sudden the flow of urine just cut off. That tells you where the tumor is. It's probably sitting down there near the urethral ostium. And so having the urologist go in and take care of that should alleviate the problem. Diagnosis is most often established by cystoscopic biopsy, and in high-risk patients, urinary cytology can be an effective screening tool. It can be helpful for evaluating high-grade in situ lesions. And so some of you who might do a little bit of industrial medicine, you may have patients who periodically are dropping off a first voided urine specimen for cytology now and then as a screening tool if those patients are in exposed environments where bladder carcinoma is a concern. Due to the high incidence of second primaries, visualization of the entire upper urothelial tract is really required. Contrast urography is really the way to do that. In many cases, urologists will do this just as part of the cystoscopy. They'll inject a little contrast, do some imaging studies during the cystoscopy. It just takes a few minutes to get that done. So that may be a common thing that you'll see people do. In working these patients up for staging, cystoscopic examination of the bladder, biopsy, rectal examination, and in women, a vaginal examination under anesthesia, contrast urography, which we've already mentioned, chest x-ray to evaluate for the potential presence of pulmonary metastases, baseline biochemical and hematologic studies. We don't typically do CT scanning of the abdomen and pelvis unless we feel that patients might be at an increased risk, in which case those are certainly very appropriate studies to exclude local spread and distant metastases. So for treatment of carcinoma in situ, this is frequently a multifocal disease, and we want to tailor treatment to the individual. Some of these can be managed very easily by intravesical chemotherapy. If we have patients who have voiding symptoms, or if we have progressive symptoms, or we demonstrate invasiveness, that's an adverse prognostic sign, and those patients are urged to undergo a cystectomy. So they may give you a case of a patient who historically has had this low-grade in situ thing, but now all of a sudden we've got evidence of early muscle invasion, you want to think about the possibility of a cystectomy because there's virtually a 100% cure rate in that setting. Close follow-up is required. These people usually have an established relationship with the urologist, following along very carefully. So these other superficial low-grade lesions, best managed by transurethral surgery. Tumor recurrence is the rule. Multiple surgeries are the norm. And I think probably if you've been doing this for a little while, you probably have four or five people that you're taking care of, and this is kind of an ongoing thing for them. You know, they go in and see the urologist periodically, and the thing doesn't seem to really invade anywhere, but they just kind of go in and have it taken care of periodically. And, you know, maybe every couple of years they'll have a transurethral resection of a bladder tumor, or they'll get some intravesical chemotherapy or something like that. In fact, intravesical chemotherapy is a value for patients with frequent recurrences and non-invasive disease. Typical drug of choice here is intravesical BCG for most patients. Treatment of high-grade lesions, and these would be patients who have muscle-invasive disease, they've got stage 2 or higher disease. We know that simple transurethral resection of bladder tumor is seldom going to be adequate. Those patients are going to need to consider resection of the involved bladder. In many cases, that's going to involve a total cystectomy, but we've seen some studies where patients will have just confined disease to one segment of the bladder, and a partial cystectomy is a consideration in that situation. The overall survival rate is about 25% with surgery alone, which would lead you to think that many of these patients are going to need to be considered for potential additional therapies. We know that radiation therapy doesn't seem to be of benefit in terms of improving disease-free or overall survival. In patients who were unable to undergo surgery and were treating them palliatively, it can certainly help manage symptoms, but doesn't really seem to help too much in this situation. So adjuvant chemotherapy is often considered, as we typically would think of, for more advanced disease. So of those patients who have advanced disease, these would be patients with stage 4 disease or really aggressive stage 3 disease that's on its way to becoming stage 4 very quickly. Surgical fulguration and resection for palliative benefit would be appropriate. Radiation can be of use for local control and relief of urinary symptoms. Most of these patients are going to be considered by combination chemotherapy, but this is going to be for palliative intent. These patients, by and large, are not curable. We are fortunate in that we have a wide variety of agents that can be used. used, and we will typically consider use of chemotherapy in terms of doublets, triplets, or even quadruplets. We've got quite a list of things to consider. Cisplatin-based regimens are currently favored for this disease, and I think my personal favorite is a combination of gemcitabine and cisplatin. It seems to be a nice crossover between effective therapy and control of symptoms and toxicities. There's only been one trial comparing that with the older and generally better established MVAC regimen, which is a four-drug regimen with four drugs that, you know, two or three of these are reasonably toxic. Adriamycin, cisplatin, certainly not kid stuff. That's pretty tough stuff. We've seen non-inferiority of the two-drug regimen, gemcitabine-cisplatin, in comparison with the four-drug regimen. No study has really said that gemcitabine-cisplatin is superior. So, you know, it has to look a little bit at nomenclature and the way the studies are set up. But if I'm treating palliatively, I'm going to tend to want to favor patients for being treated with agents that are going to be a little bit less toxic and things that they can get through. So that's just a personal opinion. So let's take a look next at prostate cancer. It's the most common cancer in men, over 180,000 cases and 26,000 deaths per year. Median age at onset is going to be, you know, kind of middle-aged to a little bit older than middle-aged, about 66. The incidence increases exponentially after the age of 40. 98% of all prostate cancers are going to be adenocarcinomas. The remainder are sarcomas or transitional cell carcinomas, probably from, you know, a little bit of the urethra as it goes through the prostate. But, you know, you might get a small cell carcinoma of the prostate that shows up on the board exam. Kind of an unusual thing. How would you treat it? Well, the answer is that you treat it just like you would small cell carcinoma of the lung. You would consider a platinum agent along with etoposide in that particular setting. So that would be how you'd manage that. There's also this thing called prostatic intraepithelial neoplasia, or PIN. Does it stand for pain in the neck? It's PIN, prostatic intraepithelial neoplasia. The high-grade form can be a precursor for adenocarcinoma, so certainly something to keep your eyes peeled about. We don't really know what causes prostate carcinoma. We have found that there's probably an environmental component to this. It appears to be more common in westernized society. Some familial clustering has been found, but we've really not found a linker gene where we can say, well, the presence of this gene confers X percentage, so it's not like the BRCA gene in breast cancer. We really haven't been able to do that yet. This is uplifting. Autopsy studies have found occult prostate cancer in as much as 40% of males over 75 years of age. And my old boss in fellowship, Chris Logothetis, used to say if you took 100 guys to surgery on their 50th birthday, you cut out their prostate and looked at it, probably in about 25 to 35% of those guys, you would find evidence of occult prostate carcinoma. If every guy gets his own prostate back, no fair switching, and you follow them for another 20 years, only 10% of them are ever going to develop clinical evidence of prostate cancer. So now the question is, what about the other 25%? What do you do with that? They never developed symptomatic disease, never required treatment, so you didn't have to worry about it. But doggone, that 10% that did, you got a real problem on your hand and a potential killer to have to contend with. So it's a really challenging disease, I think. It just nothing out there that quite behaves like it. Fortunately, as far as clinical presentation, most of these are asymptomatic, but that, of course, is also the problem in that most of these are asymptomatic. We do discover these with a routine rectal examination and can identify palpable changes. Many of these people are going to present with obstructive uropathy, and you find carcinoma, and the urologist is working it up for something else, and lo and behold, there's occult prostate cancer there. If it's widespread, patients are going to complain of leg edema, leg pain, pelvic fullness from metastases. Additionally, metastases to the bone and lung can occur. You can have liver metastases, but they're really not all that common. As far as diagnosis is concerned, if it's a mass, it probably needs to be biopsied. Most of these are done as a transrectal approach. It's either through direct palpation or maybe ultrasound guidance. 80 to 90% success rate. If they ask you about complications, fortunately, they're pretty uncommon. Bleeding, abscess formation, and things like that. I usually tell the guy, you know, it's going to be uncomfortable, and you're probably not going to feel like doing a whole lot the rest of the day. I've known guys who decided, yeah, I'll go in first thing in the morning, and then I'll go to work. And I get this phone call from the patient about 9:30 in the morning. Hey, doc, you know, it wasn't that it was so bad, but man, you know, I just don't feel real good. Yeah, this is why I said, why don't you take the day off and just take it easy. It really isn't all that bad. It's just that sometimes you don't feel really good. There's a limited role for tumor markers. We've kind of discussed the PSA debate and don't want to get too much into that because I think because it's controversial, they probably will stay away from it. I think historically we have seen that PSA can help guide our thought process, but it's important to remember that PSA can be elevated in men with benign prostatic hypertrophy. Makes it a little bit of a challenge. You can also see a mild increase in PSA on manipulation of the prostate. It's not like the older prostatic acid phosphatase problems where we never did a rectal exam if we hadn't drawn blood on the patient first. I still tend to do that just because that was the way that I was trained, but it's questionable if you typically are fairly gentle with your examination, you're probably not going to affect the level all that much. We've done other things to try to evaluate this. You know, we've done free versus bound PSA, PSA velocity, trying to come up with strategies to figure out how we're going to approach this. We do know that in men who have had prostatectomies, if we're seeing progressive increases in the PSA over time, that is likely indicative of recurrent tumor, and further evaluation is certainly warranted. So to work these guys up, you want to think about a physical and rectal exam. PSA would be appropriate depending upon what national guidelines say. Again, I think if you feel like this patient has prostate cancer, it's certainly reasonable to consider that as a test. Chest x-ray, prostate nodule biopsy, bone scan, and CT scan of the pelvis to help address nodal status would be the way to think about working those people up. We will then go through a process of tumor grading and staging. So it gets graded 1 through 5 on 2 components. That is nuclear differentiation and cellular composition, and then we come up with an aggregate score. Historically, what you got was just the sum of those two numbers. You know, it was Gleason score of 5 or Gleason score of 6. Nowadays, we tend to include both of those numbers because they speak specifically to the degree of nuclear differentiation and the degree of cellular composition. We think both of those tend to help us understand a little bit more about the nature of the disease that we're treating. So they may give you a score like a Gleason 3 plus 3 equals 6. So that may give you a little bit of an extra clue. So if you see that, at least you know it may be coming on the examination. So essentially, looking at those whole numbers, those sum numbers, I guess I should say, 2 to 4 are the good actors. They're well differentiated. They're going to closely resemble normal glands. 5 to 6, moderately well differentiated, some glandular appearance. The breakover point, though, really seems to be those people who have a Gleason score of 7. 7 is, you know, it's really starting to get nasty. 8, 9, and 10 are going to be the bad actors. They're poorly differentiated, very short response to therapy, to their hormonal manipulations. As far as treatment is concerned, the roles of surgery and radiation are still not clearly defined, and I think that's part of the challenge that we have with this disease. We're probably 15 to 18 years behind where we are in a lot of other cancers right now in understanding their role. Significant overlap in treatment exists, and treatment for most men can be tailored to meet the needs of the individual. Well, now that's kind of the cool part if you think about the art of medicine, because now you're going to be in a situation where if you get asked an exam question, kind of think about what the best approach might be. We talked about looking at some of those associated factors and trying to get a sense for the patient in front of you. Would you really want to commit a 70-year-old man who comes in to see you in a wheelchair to a prostatectomy? Would it maybe be more effective to consider a course of radiation therapy, possibly androgen deprivation therapy? Would that be a good fit? So you've got a way to kind of think through that. The goal is to try to maintain urinary continence in the majority of patients, and we can do that in about 75 to 85% of cases now. So for stage 1 disease, this is, remember, clinically occult. This is one of those things where we just sort of discovered this serendipitously. If you've got older patients, and older here, the breakover point seems to be around 70 to 75, somewhere in that neck of the woods, and it depends, admittedly, on who you read. Older patients can be managed by watchful waiting. Remember, we talked about how a third to 40% of these guys are going to have occult prostate cancer at the time of autopsy. The majority of them will never have evidence of active disease. So a lot of these guys can be managed with watchful waiting. If they have histologically aggressive disease and they're over 70, we can probably manage them conservatively with radiotherapy or with brachytherapy. So it's kind of a combination application of radiation in surgery, they'll go in and put radioactive seeds into the prostate itself and just do brachytherapy in that regard. Younger patients usually are considered for either radiation therapy or radical prostatectomy. The treatment results really don't seem to waver all that much, and you can tailor the approach to the needs of the patient. For stage 2 disease, now we have clinically palpable disease. You can tailor the treatment again to the age and overall performance status of the patient. Again, watchful waiting is a reasonable option for older patients who have indolent tumor. The standard therapy in this situation really seems to favor radical prostatectomy. Those patients who have palpable disease, this would be T2 disease, or with microscopically diffuse disease, are going to be at increased risk for metastases. In that situation, you'd want to think about doing a lymphadenectomy if you have patients who can undergo the procedure. Now, it's interesting because external beam radiation and brachytherapy are still very effective. There are some older studies that show that there's efficacy there. Some of the more recent studies really demonstrate that, you know, it looks like there might be a slight advantage to prostatectomy in this setting. But this demonstrates part of the challenge that we have. You walk away from this not really feeling all that comfortable. So the reason that I'm taking time telling you this is it's important to realize that they will probably try to stay away from these little areas where it's not entirely clear. I really think they'll try to keep it fairly clear for you. With stage 3 disease, now we know we've got disease that's a little more advanced. Seminal vesicle involvement factors in many cases to this situation. And as we might expect, prostatectomy with lymphadenectomy and radiation therapy are virtually identical. Why? Because these patients tend to develop distant metastases at about the same time, no matter what their situation is. So we get into a situation where these patients are going to have advancing disease fairly quickly. Chemotherapy doesn't help, but interestingly enough, there's some studies out there that demonstrate that hormonal therapy for 1 to 2 years may help control that disease and may lengthen the disease-free survival. So certainly worth considering. For stage 4, metastatic disease, these patients all tend to get treated up front with androgen deprivation therapy. So that's the concept. If they have painful bony metastases, you want to make sure that you consider radiation therapy. Now, if I were to ask a board question about this situation, it will be in a guy with stage 4 disease where you don't need to do a prostatectomy. And what happens is he gets to see his urologist, and he's a little bit ambivalent about whether or not he wants to do a shot and his pills and things like that. You want to try to get that testosterone blockade on board a few days early in patients who have early obstructive symptoms, because you can get a tumor flare if you just use the LHRH agonist. So they get a shot of Leuprolide, or they get a shot of Goserelin, and bang, they get it. The next thing you know, they come in with urinary obstructive symptoms. So you want to block them down first, have them come back 10 to 14 days later, and then get the shot. That's the best way to manage that. So you might get a board question with that on it. So it's important to keep that in mind. Chemotherapy, the gateway drug here is going to be docetaxel. It's not used for patients other than stage 4, and you have to demonstrate that your disease is now independent of hormonal manipulation. It's very, very important. We're going to talk next about germ cell tumors. We'll wrap this up, and then we'll get into cancer in women. So talk a little bit about germ cell tumors. These are kind of interesting things, and I think the reason why they find their way onto board exams is because this is the one disease that tends to be fairly unique, fairly rapidly growing cancer, and we've got a lot of good things available for it. It's only about 1% of all male cancers, about 8,700 per year, but it's the most common solid tumor in males between the ages of 29 and 35. There are 3 peak age groups that we have to consider. In infants, embryonal carcinoma, and yolk sac tumors, young adults, all types can occur. In older adults, it's going to be primarily seminomas. There's a really strong relationship, if you remember, between cryptorchidism and the development of testicular tumors. We really don't know what causes this, but that's the linkage that we have. A lot of these guys are going to come in complaining of scrotal swelling. They may have discomfort. They may have heaviness. Pain is reported less than 20% of the time. When it happens, it's usually in the scrotum. But if they get progressive lymphadenopathy in the retroperitoneal nodes, they may come in complaining of back pain. Gynecomastia. Know about gynecomastia in germ cell tumors. 10 to 15% of the time, which is not a lot, but when it occurs, Having a germ cell tumor in a young gentleman is the most common cause of gynecomastia. Very important to realize that. And they'll also present with things like fatigue, malaise, weight loss, and fever. That certainly goes along with the package as well. So we think in terms pathologically of the seminomas and the non-seminomas. We also know that germ cell tumors tend to occur in the testis, but they can also occur in primordial germ cell nests in the retroperitoneum. So the possibility of developing an extragonadal germ cell tumor is always a consideration. And I've provided this slide to kind of help you just brush up on the layers that we have to think about and where these types of diseases can occur. Seminoma subtypes and non-seminoma subtypes are certainly here. It's probably helpful to have some awareness, but I think in the interest of time, I want to get into some of the clinical aspects and treatment aspects of this. The natural course of this is metastases to the retroperitoneum. Occasionally, hematogenous spread can occur, but the good news is they're mostly treatable and mostly curable, which is why we want to make sure we get them worked up. If you're going to do a biopsy, the proper way to do it is to deliver the testis out through the inguinal canal and do a radical orchiectomy. Most cases, you're suspecting this based upon your evaluation. So you don't want to do a transscrotal biopsy. It now changes the lymph node metastatic pattern. People can develop problems with lymphedema involving the lower extremities, and it can be a real problem. Tumor markers can be helpful as a part of the workup. It's probably one of the few areas where, you know, I wouldn't judge adversely anybody who said, well, they've got a scrotal mass and we're concerned about testicular carcinoma. It's time to do an AFP and a beta HCG. It can be helpful. You will often find that they are normal in seminoma, but they are going to be elevated in non-seminomas, so that can certainly help. If you're looking for seminomas, what we'll traditionally do is look at LDH, and it's isotype 1 that we're going to look for. Traditionally, 2 is greater than 1. In this situation, 1 will be greater than 2. So you see that flip. Start thinking about a seminoma in your patient. Additional workup is going to include a chest x-ray, tumor markers, CT scan of the abdomen and pelvis. We will also ultrasound the testis to get a sense about how things are looking. Do both testes. There's a 15% incidence of bilaterality in this situation, so we don't want to miss that. The treatment for surgery is going to be a radical orchiectomy. Again, this is removal of the affected testis in the spermatic cord. This allows for determination of adverse prognostic factors and really helps us with a precise pathologic diagnosis. What about retroperitoneal lymph node dissection? Here we're grossly exonerating all of the periaortic, iliac, and presacral lymph nodes. This is a fairly morbid type of procedure, which is why you'll be glad that this occurs primarily in young men, because it really is hard to get older gentlemen through this. Lymphedema, ileus, post-op recovery, they can be really, really tough. What about radiation? It can be effective, usually to the retroperitoneum, and it's given for retroperitoneal treatment in patients who are not surgical candidates. It's given for residual mass after treatment for seminoma, and it's given as a part of multimodal therapy. Those would be the situations where we would think about utilizing it. So for chemotherapy, the cornerstone is going to be a platinum-containing compound. Traditionally, it's a platinum along with bleomycin and etoposide. Both seminomas and non-seminomas, again, are very responsive. These patients really do pretty well. It is pretty rigorous therapy, though, and hospitalizations at intervals are usually the course for neutropenic fever, nausea and vomiting. And of course, if you're using bleomycin, you're going to have to be worried about pulmonary fibrosis. And so you have to monitor that. In those patients who would receive adriamycin, cardiotoxicity is also going to be a consideration. So let's break this down. Treatment of seminoma versus non-seminoma. For stage 1, to radical orchiectomy, followed by active surveillance. If you have patients who are really not going to be interested in active surveillance, it's possible to consider retroperitoneal radiation in those people. It's curative in the majority of patients if we approach those early tumors that way. For patients who have retroperitoneal lymph node involvement that's early or maybe a little bit more bulky, radical orchiectomy followed by radiation. radiation. If those patients can't take radiation, chemotherapy can be a consideration. If we have patients who now have bulky disease, if they've got stage 2C, or that should be stage 3 disease, which would be above the level of the diaphragm, radical orchiectomy followed by chemotherapy would be the approach. For the non-seminomas, there's a little bit of subtlety here. To be honest with you, I don't think they're going to get into the subtle issues, but I wouldn't be doing my job if I didn't discuss the maybe subtle difference. Here for a stage one tumor, we have a patient who's just got diseases confined to the organ itself. Radical orchiectomy followed by retroperitoneal lymph node dissection is an appropriate approach. If you have conscientious patients, it's reasonable to observe them and not proceed with retroperitoneal lymph node dissection. The idea is that if they progress, they can go to retroperitoneal lymph node dissection at that point and still derive the same benefit. And you may have a subpopulation of patients who never had to have retroperitoneal node dissection. We save them a fairly morbid procedure. For those patients who now have progressive disease with pelvic and retroperitoneal nodes, radical orchiectomy with either retroperitoneal lymph node dissection or chemotherapy would be the approach. For those people who develop bulky retroperitoneal adenopathy, that's 2C, or patients who develop disease above the diaphragm, radical orchiectomy and chemotherapy. Sometimes these patients will have a little bit of residual tumor. We can go back and resect it. If you get asked on a board question, so you had a patient who had non-seminoma, went through all this treatment, that there was residual nodularity and they went back and got it, what would the pathology specimen show? Interestingly enough, it would probably show teratoma. Generally, it's mature teratoma. Every once in a while, it's immature. Remember, for teratoma, you got to have all three germ cell layers to be there. So that would probably be the answer to that question.